The Crude Life with host Jason Spies.
All right, let's go to the Zoom line where we've got Mr. Terry Edom on the line with us, Canada's greatest export. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm very good. Thanks, Jason. Very much better since you called me that.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, well, you know, you kind of are Canada's greatest export. I mean, you're there in Calgary, but you export so much information across the globe that, you know, you're kind of one of those soothsayers on one hand, and on the other hand, you know, you've always been, you know, there's a common ground, folks. There's a common ground. Can we just stop the, I call it sports shouting, you know, where you just shout over each other with sports facts? Because in sports, nobody's ever wrong. So it's always...
No, that's right. Everybody's an expert, armchair expert.
And so in politics, you start to have the same thing. And you've seen how the oil and gas industry has become politicized over the past decade, especially over the past 4 to 5 years. Let's get an update from Canada. Let's get an update from your book. Let's get an update from your blog, Public Energy Number One. And I just saw an article you did in the BOE report. I thought it was great. It was great. And it's getting some great traction on social media. You're basically saying, hey, folks, when Henry Ford came out with the Model T, he didn't tell all the people to go shoot their horses, did they? So let's start off by that a little bit. First of all, how are you doing up there in Canada?
Getting by. It's crazy times. It's for, say, for you, and or just like for you, I guess. And the world is just upside down, so it's hard to make sense out of anything. I guess the one thing that I'm grateful for, and I hope our friends just across the border here are too, are that we are in the oil and gas industry, and the world has needed it like never before, and that proof is showing up everywhere. It's just incontrovertible now, the fact that we can't transition away from hydrocarbons anytime soon. And I guess people have to get put in the worst possible place before they'll recognize that. So you asked a few things about how things are going in Canada. Well, we still have our left-leaning governments, I'll try and be polite, in our nation's capital here, who refuse to accept the value of our industry. Germany came begging for LNG a few months ago. It was pathetic. I almost cried. They showed up in Ottawa and wanted to meet with our government and ask for a pledge that we would send LNG their way, since Russia's being Russia. And our prime minister said there's no economic case to ship LNG from Canada's East Coast. And everybody that knows anything about energy just fell over on the floor twitching. There's no way you can make a statement like that and understand the first thing about energy. And so Germany just left, and we promised them green hydrogen someday when a green hydrogen industry develops, which is still a theoretical beast on the drawing board, which governments will want to approve and regulate and monitor. And they don't even have a game plan for that yet. And so that was his solution to this winter's German energy crisis. So that's the state of Canada. We're being led by people who are convinced that the energy transition is in full swing, and the rest of the world is saying it is not. So, and my article in the BOE report, that's just, I appreciate your comments. I do try and write in a way that just appeals to the every person. I really don't give a crap whether people like it or not. It's just, I say what I say, and it does resonate. I have a lot of listeners in Africa and Europe and all over the place. So it's kind of neat to hear from people that say, hey, appreciate a fresh voice.
That was the thing that I found with the Crude Life. You know, we went non-political, was it 8 years ago when we started publicly saying that we were non-political? And honestly, it was because everybody else was political. You know, we couldn't you couldn't even turn on SportsCenter without them telling me how to feel during the national anthem, for crying out loud. I mean, when The View is getting into politics, and I mean, you couldn't get anything, right? So I thought, you know what? We'll just go non-political with the Crude Life. And boy, our audience shot up. And like you said, we were starting to see European listeners and African listeners and South American listeners. And pretty soon you start to see that there's a pretty big world out there that is just craving non-political energy news. And so talk about your book a little bit, because, you know, your title seems a little bit aggressive at first, but then when you read it, you're like, oh, he's going down the middle ground. It's end what is it? End the fossil fuel
the,
and
the end of fossil fuel insanity. And the subtitle is clearing the air before cleaning the air. And I chose that title on purpose. The editor suggested I change it to something different. And I said, nah, I like that because people don't know how to take it. There were some people when it came out that said, oh, good, this guy's cheering on the death of the fossil fuel industry. It's like, no, not at all. But the insanity is just the political angle that's been attached to the energy industry. Now, I guess energy has always been kind of political. There's always been a desperate search for energy, and so that brings geopolitics into play. That's just kind of unavoidable. But the politicization now, like you're saying, is ridiculous. It's you have these little kids lecturing the United Nations on that they must stop using fossil fuels and bawling on stage and getting ovations for it, and it's just ludicrous. So, and I try and be apolitical. I start off taking shots at our politicians, but that's just kind of a cultural thing that's embedded everywhere, and I don't mean to be political about it. It attacks politicians of all stripes. Mm-hmm. And that's why I try and just talk about energy. I just say, I don't want to talk about climate change. That's political football, and you can argue it till you're all dead. I'm just going to talk about energy and what can happen and what can't happen. And it's much easier to keep a clear head, and it's much easier to be truthful and objective in what you're trying to say. When you say the world's running out of fuel, people can jump all over you all you like, but you can show them some charts that show that that is the case. When you see bidding wars for natural gas around the world, where you see a country like Pakistan literally unable to buy natural gas because they're being outbid for every cargo by Europe. So what is a country like that to do? 100 million people or something like that that cannot find a source of fuel for the upcoming winter. What does that mean for Pakistan? Media doesn't like to talk about that, but that's the realities on the ground. And the people of Pakistan are more than happy when someone will acknowledge their issues.
You mentioned Germany coming over, trying to get some energy from you guys, from Canada, you guys. Listen to me. Boy, can't tell. We're from the upper Midwest here, can you?
So, okay. I can almost hit you with a golf ball from here, yeah.
Maybe we can go about in the boat later and have a good time. grab a North Dakota and a Canadian and put the mic in front of them. Boy, that's some good listening there, folks. Take a step back for a second here because really, you know, you're up in Canada and Canada really got on this anti-fossil fuel movement much sooner than America did. And America is going down this path through ESG. Now, you can comment on ESG in just a second, but I wanted to point out an example of ESG through Canada, which is my understanding is Canada's going to have some government-sponsored food shortages next year because they don't want anything to do with fertilizer. And so this just quick change in how people are farming is probably going to have some food shortage impacts. And that is an ESG supply chain issue of trying to get rid of fossil fuels. Germany coming over to Canada, asking them for some energy. That is an ESG supply chain issue when it comes to energy. What's going on in Canada when it comes to ESG? And just clarify that whole fertilizer pesticide comment I made, because, yeah, it's not so much government-sponsored food shortages. That's more of a prediction by me, I guess.
Yeah, I think Canada will be all right just because we have so few people and so much agriculture here. But the squeeze you're talking about is just the devious way that governments try and achieve their emissions objectives now. And it might be just sheer stupidity or ignorance. So what the government has said, the government is very shrewd here and careful. They say, oh, wait a minute, we're not banning fertilizer. We're just saying you have to cut 30% of the emissions from fertilizer use. And farmers are saying, well, that's exactly the same thing. You can't tell us to cut the emissions from fertilizer use without cutting fertilizer. And the government's like, well, no, that's sort of your problem. So there you will see a shift in crops. And this is probably going to hit the U.S. too at some point. Canada blindly follows the United Nations and Europe. That's just our view of our leaders. They think that the U.N. and the EU are setting the agenda for ESG and everything else. So we just follow them. In past, we've had leaders which recognize the value of our relationship with the United States, our biggest trading partner, and have tended to worry about that more, and I long for those days again. Longest undefended border in the world. Let's keep it that way. And so it's our politicians just follow in the lead of people that don't understand what they're even talking about. And Europe is much worse. In the Netherlands, Netherlands is one of the biggest food exporters in the world. I didn't realize that until it started happening. And they're actually, they're doing the same thing to their farmers, and they're doing it first, which is why I think Canada just copied. But they're saying you can't use as much fertilizer, and they're actually ordering some farms to be abandoned. Like they're ordering farmers to cease operations and sell their farms. They're offering to buy them out, but they're saying you can no longer farm in these jurisdictions. So it's insanity at heading into food shortages. At the same time, this is compounding the problem of high global natural gas prices, which are making fertilizer unaffordable anyways. So there's it's like we have this problem that's a massive problem for the world, a fertilizer shortage, and then these governments are just compounding it for no reason other than some virtue signaling ESG. And then to get to the topic of ESG, it's almost a crime to me that something under the banner of environmental, social, and governance becomes such a political football. Like everyone is in favor of a cleaner environment. I know you work hard to generate forests down there, and people like to minimize their footprint. No one likes pollution. No one likes to see spills. That's just a universal of humanity, I think. And instead of us worrying about that, we've turned ESG into a political animal where it's become singularly focused on, well, there's the whole race thing and whatever. I'm not even going to get into that, but in governance, but the ESG movement is now a CO2 movement. And then it's becoming that way globally, where ESG is synonymous with CO2 reduction. And that's just a recipe for disaster, as we're seeing. There's no good path to short-term path here to decarbonize. I think planting trees is the best way to do it if you're going to, and nuclear, and then worry about the emissions, but go after the biggest, the 80-20 rule, where 80% of the problem comes from first. And if we were to focus on that, then maybe we could get somewhere in terms of reducing even CO2 emissions, but just pollution in general. But we just don't do that. We instead choose to do crazy things over here because we're wealthy enough that we can afford to get away with them. And the rest of the world is just watching in disbelief. And people like Putin step right into the void, and they just manipulate this and milk it for all it's worth. And it's you see the consequences of that. So we have dumb actors in Western leadership giving all control to bad actors in other parts of the world. And it's a crime against humanity, and it's sad to watch, but what can you do?
Kind of a food PSA too, that also in the Ukraine, Russia burned like 5 million, 4 million, 6 million acres of wheat as well. So not only do you have countries doing this manufactured consent on the farmers, but also you've got war happening where they're using, you know, burning of fields as part of warfare. So I do think that you're going to start to see some major inflation. I don't even think inflation has started yet. I mean, I hate to say it, but we're probably at the 20-yard line, dude. I mean, how is Canadian inflation doing?
Well, it's just like everyone else's. It's insane. It's just and there's even shortages of some things. I was trying to find a secondhand car all for the past 8 months, and I'm not paying new prices for an old used car. And yeah, the price of everything is just marching up. I think it's a global phenomenon. I don't know that you can't. I know people up here are blaming our prime minister for inflation, and probably they're blaming Biden for inflation. And that's not directly true, but indirectly is part of this whole movement that is energy underpins everything. And when you create a shortage of energy and drive up the price, then that drives up the price of everything. So I think there's all of the crazy government borrowing that's been going on for years, and we're all in debt up to our eyeballs, the governments of the world. But I think the biggest problem, and I agree with you right now, I don't think we're even going yet on inflation because it's energy driven. And what happens when there's a shortage of aluminum and a shortage of fertilizer and a shortage, then that's going to get baked into the price of everything. So those things will get bid up in price even more than they are now. And the more the energy squeeze happens, the more Germany stops producing industrial chemicals, the more somebody else will, and the more the price will go up. So we're just getting going on inflation. It's going to be awful.
You know, we were talking yesterday on the radio on Super Talk 1270 Bismarck about in New Zealand, they were starting to, or they introduced, the government of New Zealand introduced legislation or whatever they call it over there to tax cows and sheep that, you know, pee and burp and poop and stuff like that because of the methane. And as ridiculous as that is, that is the direction that our leadership is taking us, is down that type of just, I don't even know how to call it, but at the end of the day, what we pointed out was that this technology is now there. They tried to do it in the early 2000s where in America, they actually tried to get all the farmers to count the head of cattle for tax reasons. Well, the farmers came back and they said, well, we can't do that. Well, now they have drones. So now they can just tell everybody, well, go buy a drone. Well, we can't afford it. Well, we'll give you a little bit of money for it, and then you can go track it, and then we'll get it on the back end with the taxes. So it's really quite incredible. This you call it a squeeze, and I, you know, whether it's inflation, is every time I look around, what you're talking about is exactly right, which is from the energy point of view, which is the root of everything, okay. Mm-hmm. They're starting to tax and they're starting to drive up the prices. The only thing that you can bypass is some sort of agriculture if you bypass the pesticides and herbicides and all these other things. But even that now, they're going to tax as well. So no matter where you look at it, the root cause of what you eat and what you heat your homes with and what you drive your vehicles with, whether you have an EV car or a gas combustible car, the taxes are going up and up and up. That's why I don't think inflation's even started yet, is because, Anyway, well, go ahead.
I think you're absolutely right. And it's kind of, I follow a bunch of economists and they're so used to gauging inflation in terms of just the standard, the government has to reduce interest rates too low and that created the inflation and they'll increase interest rates and that'll reduce the inflation. It's like, no, I think this is a different world we're in. I think this is an actual physical shortage of things kind of inflation where it's there's just not enough of whatever to go around. And we lose sight of the fact of everything because it just shows up in our supermarket and Home Depot and Home Hardware or whatever. And so that's Canadian chain, Home Depot. All of that stuff just appears miraculously. And
time out. Be kind, rewind here. Back the truck up. Home Depot is a Canadian chain?
No. Home Hardware is a Canadian chain.
Home Hardware. Okay, I was going to say, if Home Depot is a Canadian chain, I got some jokes that I'm only going to make on the podcast after hours. Okay. Anyways, go on.
I'm sorry. I was wrong there. We lose sight of the fact that there's 8 billion people on Earth now that all have to be fed every single day, 3 times a day, or maybe once or twice for the less fortunate parts of the world. But that food only exists in this steady flow because of pesticides, herbicides, fertilizer that allow us to grow these crops in these massive quantities. Like a farm is an incredibly efficient beast now. I grew up on a farm and I hardly recognize it when I go drive through the fields. There are tractors on GPS marching around the field on autopilot and the yields are spectacular and they fertilize. They have a map of a field where fertilizer is optimized for each little sector of the field, every little hill, mini hill, which is like a few feet above the others, which has a different soil composition, gets a different fertilizer treatment. And it's so scientific and so smart and so beautiful. And we take that for granted. And here governments come marching into the middle of it saying, we're going to rip this all apart. And by the way, we're going to take all your corn and we're going to ship it for ethanol because we need to meet some fuel standard. And so that limits the supply of food even more. So it's, the governments are acting so irresponsibly that it's just really breathtaking.
What do you have in Calgary Edmonton and Calgary are known as, you know, the oil and gas hot spots when it comes to Canadian energy. There might be some other places too, but those are the two that come to mind right
off the top. That's in Canada. Right? That's it. Yeah.
Okay. What's going on up there? I haven't heard much out of Edmonton lately, but is Calgary still getting some gas, or what do you guys? That's right. Your day job, actually. You kind of work or are part of a natural gas company.
Yeah, little natural gas company. Yeah. So it's a really bizarre time in the industry. So we survived a bunch of lean years where the cash flow went to near zero or negative for some companies. A lot of them went out of business. The ones that survived are like hardened street rats now, and they're. And then at the same time, prices rebounded back in a way that almost no one foresaw, natural gas and oil at the same time. So the cash flow being generated now is just unbelievable, which you would think would be cause for celebration. And it's more of a sigh of relief, but it's really weird this time around. So we have a boom, and the market in Canada and the US and around the world is signaling, we want more oil, we want more natural gas, we need it, we're willing to pay for it. And the producing community is saying, it's too bad. We're taking all our surplus cash flow and we're giving it back to shareholders because the whole world hates us. And nobody wants us to grow. Nobody will allow us to build new pipelines, new infrastructure. There's protesters everywhere. We're just kind of done with this. So you want us to wither? We're going to wither. And we're taking all our excess cash flow and we're shipping it out of the industry. And so that it's this very, very weird environment. And now we see governments starting to pile on and look at all these profits and going, hey, wait a minute, you're making all this money on the backs of consumers. So either produce more or give us all your money. And we say, well, okay, we'll produce more, but we need to build a pipeline. We can't build a pipeline. Okay, we want to build an LNG export terminal. I'm sorry, you can't build an LNG. So what do you want? We want you to produce more, but with no emissions. But then we're going to work hard to throttle you anyways. And this is happening in the US too. That's why you see guys like Toby Rice being so wonderfully outspoken, the head of EQT, just with these brilliant talks about how the world needs North American energy. And we have to be very thankful for what we have here, man. We're so lucky that we have the agriculture and the energy sector that we do, and our prices that aren't reflective of the global ones. Oil is priced globally. Natural gas is still... The U.S. price for natural gas and the Canadian one is about, I don't know, a quarter to a sixth of the global price. So it's we have to be thankful for that, too. In one sense, it keeps our manufacturing sector healthy. I think you're going to see a lot of manufacturing start moving from places like Europe to the United States because of the cheap available natural gas. You might see places like Pennsylvania just absolutely boom, unless governments try and thwart it, but you might see a lot of manufacturing return because there's so much natural gas right there that's bottlenecked that can't get to the global markets that need it.
No, I think you're exactly right. You're going to see a resurgence of manufacturing coming back because it's mostly going to be artificial intelligence, and they can get the younger people to do it. And so,
run the robots.
Yeah, that's what they're going to have, the younger people running their iPads and robots and paying, you know, a lot less for these types of things. But it's going to be very energy intensive in order to do this. They're going to talk about how it's not, but you know as well as I do, just even to construct a robot, that takes a lot of energy just to make one.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And so. Anyway, but I agree with you that you're going to see this kind of this resurgence coming of manufacturing. It's going to be different, though. It's going to be a totally different manufacturing industry than what people are used to. Hey, what happened up in Calgary and Edmonton over the last, 5 years? Because, you know, Canadian oil and gas, you guys got hit hard and got hit hard fast.
We did, and it was – so the industry up here was running 100 miles an hour. Well, let's go back about 10 years ago. The oil sands were really booming. There's hundreds of billions of dollars being spent in the oil sands. It was crazy. It was too much development too fast, but the price of oil was dictating it. And so there was the spin-off boom. People were being hired from all over the world, I think, but people from like Eastern Canada could go to Fort McMurray in northern Alberta and get a job driving a truck for $150,000 a year and And then there were pipelines being constructed to move all that product out. And the steel fabrication shops in Edmonton were working flat out. They just couldn't find enough people. And so we went from that to the price crash in 2014, where everything really got hammered and that growth slowed dramatically. And then it was sort of stabilizing and then in a much lower pace. And then along came Greta and all of the warriors in 2019. And that's when our government here, our federal government, really, really started to send out signals that they didn't want the industry around in the long term. So that started discouraging capital
Sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to ask your opinion on something because you are a media professional. You kind of cited the Greta Thunberg movement as really being the catalyst for the current state of Canada with oil and gas. I think that's a fair way to phrase it. Would you say that was accelerated through the traditional media or social media?
I think Greta's like a complete fabrication of social media. But then traditional media picked it up because they don't know. Traditional media, I don't think, knows how to exist in this new world. They can't compete with the speed. And I'm on Twitter, which is a horrible platform just because it gets so ugly so quickly. But there are a lot of really good energy commentators on there. And I open up Twitter in the morning and I have a feed of capable people that tell me what's happening instantly within the past 10 minutes in the energy markets.
So,
and if I flip to Reuters or something, it takes them half a day and they get it wrong anyways, because they have a juvenile analysis. So,
well, the thing is, and you know this from your own eyeballs, like from me with my own eyeballs, a lot of the reporters, they don't have budgets to go to do stories. And so a lot of what they do now is they just follow people on social media. And so they just report on certain people when they get their feeds coming through. Like,
no, it's true. They quote the social media personalities.
It's like the People and Us Magazine, all the glamour Hollywood magazines, the way that they would do reporting on, Julia Roberts and George Clooney. They would grab, Pink's tweet and put it on there and do a whole story around it. Like, oh, look at Pink. She's in a bikini. And all of a sudden, the whole news story is based on a tweet, right? Well, that's the way a lot of these other sports does it all the time. Sports, they live off of that. So it's sad though, when regular news has gone to that, to where they're now just sitting back, just sitting on social media, waiting to report on someone.
Just feeding off of someone else. You mentioned Greta. So Canada's energy in 2019 could be summed up by two pictures. Our Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, when Greta was on her world tour, she came over here in her multi-million-dollar boat, and she landed in Ottawa. He gave her a hero's welcome. He met with her, of course, a photo op. So there's one picture that hit the news where here he is giving an audience to this kid. And then he actually went and marched with her in protests in Montreal. So here he is at the front of this pack of orchestrated school children, all carrying signs saying fossil fuels are killing the planet. And that summed up Canadian energy right there. And that's all that camp, that social media horde that's been pushing the anti-fossil fuel movement, that's all they needed to hear from Canada. Here's Canada in two pictures. And here's what their leadership believes. Here's the direction they're going. And the investors around the world could see that. So you're right. It's a social media dominated narrative now. So that's how the big Bloombergs and Reuters and the New York Times and LA Times, they pick up these things and like, oh, here's Canadian energy. There's Trudeau with Greta. And it's a done deal. And then there's the industry in the background just doing what they do, not having a clue how to engage audiences or because they've just never had to do it before and still not being good at it. And they just get overran by this messaging. And for a decade, there's been people saying, there's an energy shortage coming. There's an energy shortage coming. There's an energy shortage coming. And no one listened, or they laughed at them. And they said, wind and solar are here and they're going to take over. And it's, just don't listen to the dinosaur. They're just fighting to save their dying industry. And now And now it turns out that all of those people were right, but it's kind of too late now.
Terry Edom is our guest. Just about 5 minutes left here. And you mentioned this, you know, I call it oil field entitlement, but it is an oil field arrogance. And there are a number of leaders that, and I tell this story all the time, that I was sitting in an office down in Dallas, and it's one of the top energy companies in the United States. And there was four C-level suite executives in this meeting. This was 2020. And when I, you know, started talking about the image of the industry and comparing it to the smoking ban, about how a lot of the public shaming they did through the smoking ban with the manipulation of information and just the public shaming and all this other stuff, boy, they could not have kicked me out of that room faster. They did not want to hear it. I was blackballed. I'm not kidding you. Less than a week later, the front page of the Wall Street Journal was about how it said the oil industry is the new cigarette industry, the new tobacco. Big oil is new big tobacco or something like that. And I thought, boy, we had close to, if not more, than $1 million worth of executive salaries in that room. And not one of them could see even closely what I was talking about. And not only could they not see it, they got really upset and dug their heels in and basically called security to get me the heck out of there. And here I'm on their side, and I'm on their side. So they not only can't connect in my view, and I'm being totally serious when I say this, I don't believe that the current leadership in oil and gas can connect with their industry, let alone the general public, Terry.
No, I agree. I don't even know who they can connect with. And I've spent a lot of columns yelling at our Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers, CAP, which is the equivalent of the U.S. American Petroleum Institute. It's like, where are you people? Why aren't you explaining reality? Why aren't you effectively, like, making a real effort to connect with people? There's two unbelievable examples that came out of the U.S. About a year ago, the heads of the super majors got hauled on the carpet before a congressional committee of Democrats, of course. And they took a pasting there in their chairs. They got all sorts of insults hurled at them. And they just sat there and they had almost nothing to say. It was the most hideous thing. It's like you're saying, they're aliens listening to this messaging and they don't know where it's coming from and they don't get it and they don't want to hear it. And then you had Jamie Dimon in this banking sector that a couple of weeks ago, he was in front of a Democratic committee who was outwardly hostile and very hostile towards the fossil fuel sector. And I can't remember which one of the Democrats on the panel was like going down the line of bankers saying, will you agree to stop funding fossil fuel projects? And they all said no. But Jamie Dimon said that would be the road to hell for America. And he got beat up for that, of course. But it's like that's the kind of frank talk that has been that no one in the oil patch is willing to actually stand up and say something or even like to get into these consequences. They're always talking about how good they are. Like, oh, we're here for the security supply. Don't worry. We got everything covered. But you're losing the war. And I don't even know what battle you guys are fighting, but it's something in your head that doesn't exist in the real world. So
personally, I'm starting to find it extremely insulting because a lot of the stuff that a lot of us were talking about 5 to 10 years ago, they're now getting government money to educate you and I on those things. And it's really sadistic and insulting. And
it is.
Yeah.
We were discussing this 5 years ago, Jason. So,
and by the way, and being blackballed and told we're crazy and everything else. And we were actually just trying to have a civil conversation. That's the part that blows me away is when for a lot of this, trying to have a civil conversation it all of a sudden you find out you're in an argument. You're like, well, when did this happen? When the heck did I thought we were trying to I thought we were all friends here. What's going on? I just thought I'd bring this up. This real life occurrence that happened to me. Anyway, but well, we've only got about a minute left here. I'm looking at the clock, so we better get a plug in for your book and all this other stuff. So we got to have you back, man. We got to start making this a monthly occurrence here, especially as we go into this new world. Because, you know, let's be honest, you know, the energy industry is connected. We are the North American union, really, at the end of the day, because the borders, whether it's Mexico or Canada, the trade is pretty open. So how can people help you with your business and buy your book and stuff like that?
Oh, it's very kind of you. I'll just second that first. The cross-border flows of oil and natural gas between Canada and the U.S. in particular are incredible. We send stuff your way, you send stuff our way, and it's the best relationship in the world. And I support anything to do with my American friends. And my book is called The End of Fossil Fuel Insanity. It's the best thing you'll ever read. Just kidding. But it's not bad. And it's available at Amazon.com and I think Barnes & Noble also. Read the reviews. People love it.
We will have all the links available at the show page at thecrudelife.com. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Terry Edom, Canada's greatest export. You can catch him at the BOE Report, as well as Public Energy Number 1, as well as multiple book locations to purchase it like Amazon.com. Clearing the Air and the Fossil Fuel Insanity. Mr. Terry Edom.
Have a question? Know an expert? Or just want your voice heard? Email studio@thecrudelife.com.